Hello and welcome to the Home Theatre Podcast. We're delighted to be picking things up where we left off with a special episode focusing on our Black History Month programme happening in our building throughout the whole of October. I'm Megan McGoat from the Home team, here to chat with our guests on the podcast today. I have with me film programmer, critic and curator Liz Chege, a Berlinale Talent alumnus. She is a founding member of Come the Revolution, a collective of creatives and curators committed to exploring Black life, experience and cultural expression through cinema. She has worked across international festivals and is now the festival director of Africa in Motion Festival. Our second guest is writer, performer and spoken word artist Ella McLeod. Signed by Curtis Brown Literature, Ella is currently working on her first novel, a YA fantasy fiction, where she hopes to continue writing about the Black experience with humour, honesty and a touch of whimsy. And lastly, we have musician, actor and activist Tolu Ajahi. A multi-instrumentalist and vocalist, Tolu has worked on several projects for Manchester Pride, Blue Peter, Glastonbury and Africa Oh Yeah, to name a few, and is part of Rainbow Noir, a peer support and social group for LGBTQ people of colour. Welcome everyone. You're all part of Home's Black History Month programme. So to start off with, do you want to tell us a little bit about each of your shows? Liz, let's start with you.
Hi everyone. So our home event is called the Black Mirror Representations of Race in the Horror Film. And we'll be looking at kind of three main areas for this because horror is such a wide genre. We're looking at the haunted house, the slasher movie, and the creature feature. And it will cover everything from kind of the Black Lazarus to the magical, mystical Negroes.
Great. And Ella?
So I'm part of the Storytime Sessions, which is aimed primarily at kids sort of under eight-ish. And it will be released over, I guess, the half term period. And I'm personally going to be exploring themes of mortality and really looking at ways to tackle big questions with young people.
And Tulu.
Hi, I'm going to be part of the Home Sound Sessions. So it's a showcase of three Black artists showcasing their music. And I'm going to be partnering with the drummer from my band, Pieces of a Man, and he's called Aiden. So together we are Tolu and Aiden.
Thank you very much. So at the heart of Black History Month is the recognition and celebration of important Black figures throughout history. Art and culture seems like the perfect vehicle through which to explore this contribution, a deep dive into individual and personal experience. I wonder for each of you, what role do you think arts and culture has within Black History Month and bringing these stories to light?
I think, so speaking from personal experience, as a Black British kid who grew up away from the motherland, and who's like never in fact been to the motherland because like none of my family are there anymore. My family are Jamaican. So we, you know, we're, my grandparents are Windrush generation. And so the only way really to stay in touch with my Blackness, with my heritage has been through arts and culture because I don't have that direct geographical link that other people do. So growing up listening to Black music and hearing Black stories and being given a kind of almost like a lifeline to my heritage was really, really important. And I think that more and more, you know, we're seeing more generations of young, vocal Black kids and Black people speaking out about, you know, their experience, but they're all part of the diaspora. And so I think it's a real way of us kind of maintaining connectedness, especially if, you know, yeah, you weren't raised where your family are from and you have that experience of, I guess, sometimes not feeling Black enough because you've not been raised in the same way as your grandparents. And you've not necessarily been raised around, you know, lots and lots of Jamaican people or lots and lots of Nigerian people. So other than like your family, you know. The stories that we tell and are told and the music that we listen to and things I think are really important. I hear that,
especially about being raised in a place which seems to be in conflict with your heritage or what you look like or your culture, constantly being told or reminded that you might be between two cultures rather than celebrating the best of both. Mm-hmm. Like I grew up in Merseyside, so like near Liverpool, and it was very much a white majority town where I grew up. And I grew up desperately wanting to fit in and sticking out, really like a sore thumb for the benefits of the podcast. I'm quite dark skinned. So yeah, going to an all white school, I was never going to fit in that way. And I didn't understand why. For the longest time, I couldn't even spell my name properly. It's a long name till I was about 6 years old. And even things like that, going back to Nigeria, not being able to pronounce it properly in air quotes, like Tolu, and everyone was kind of anglicizing my name, like Tolu or Tolu or however you want to say it in your accent. And so it's just questions of identity constantly growing up. And then you find yourself in arts and culture being reflected back finally, despite the people around you. And you're like, actually, this is where I can lock in. These are people who look like me, who enjoy the same things that I do. And you realize there's no sort of like, there's no gatekeeping to blackness, as it were. So I grew up kind of listening to a lot of rock, a lot of metal, actually. Which can sometimes be considered to be white culture and white music or whatever. And it's just not true. There's so many shades of blackness, and there are so many people doing the kind of music that I enjoyed, doing the kind of arts that I enjoyed, and who looked like me. And it's just, it might have taken me a little bit longer to kind of find them, but at the roots of all the stuff that I liked, actually, they were black people. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's been really, really important to me, really, really important to me to kind of like sow into arts and culture, and also to give back. And to be like, actually, regardless of what you sound like or what your accent's like or who you grew up around, you can find yourself like in the stuff that you do. Like you, if you're a black person, then you gatekeep your own blackness. Don't let anybody else do it for you. And so like, yeah, like arts and culture has been massively important for that, for me personally. Mm-hmm.
So my experience has been exactly the opposite of Tolu and Alan. I grew up in Kenya, that's where I'm from, and lived there for most of my life until I came here to study at university in Bristol. And I found Black History Month absurd. I thought that this is history that should be taught throughout the year. And I never understood the importance, like why has it been focused on so much? And that's partly because back home, we are taught a much wider range of history. And I mean, for example, my grandfather fought for the British in World War II. He was in the Navy. And that's kind of common knowledge. So when I came here and I found that there's an entire gap, multiple gaps actually, I was very, very surprised. And even having grown up in Nairobi, we saw the Desmonds, we saw Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Like we were much more, I suppose, open to the diaspora than the reverse. So when I came here, I was really, really shocked. And now that I've been here for a few years, I understand now. I understand what it means to have this Black History Month. I just wish we didn't need it. So in terms of, I think Tolu, you mentioned something really interesting about the rock music. So Kenyans are huge rock fans. And it's just interesting that, you know, coming here, just like you were saying, you know, it wasn't common knowledge that there are Black artists within that genre, including mm-hmm. metal. And it's just this constant schism. And the conversation, the theme you talked about with diaspora, that in-betweenness and feeling like it's a recurring dilemma that you're losing ground and gaining ground and you're kind of in this gray area half the time, I completely empathize now. In terms of how arts and culture I can't remember the word you used there, Meg, in the question.
How it's a vehicle for exploring people's individual stories and sort of identifying with their past.
So from a PR and marketing perspective, I understand the essence of having like so much happening. Unfortunately, it does compete. You're constantly competing with other organizations in these 30 days, you know? It should be much longer. It should be year round, 365 days a year. I suppose that's how I feel at this time.
So I guess that brings us on perfectly actually to my next question, because that's all about representation on screen. And Liz, I know that the panel discussion that you're speaking on is all about that, the one called Black Mirror. So do you feel like there's been a shift of how much Black representation there is on screen in recent years?
I think so. Not enough is my feeling. With horror, for example, in particular, we do have a history of being in horror and good horror. Unfortunately, again, there are tropes of us being murdered within the first 5 minutes. You know, it's kind of like we're quite disposable generally. But I'm seeing, you know, once in a while throughout film history, you do see some great examples of subverting those tropes. But I'm seeing, maybe within the last decade especially, a lot of change, especially in TV, and with people like Jordan Peele now, who have the power and the money to make consistent change. And I think it's great. But yes, I agree with people like McQueen. There's still lots to do, especially behind the camera. So in writing, in sound production, in many other fields. That's how I feel.
And Tulu and Ella, do you feel that you've also seen a bit of a shift in the industries that you work in, whether it's music or in spoken word and storytelling?
For me, I'm seeing a lot more queer musicians, Black queer musicians, come through and already hit the ground running as a queer person. It used to be kind of like, maybe not even 10 years ago, maybe like 10, 20 years ago, people would have to kind of establish their name for a while, get big, and then maybe dip their toe into the water of kind of like, okay, here's the whole of me as a queer person. Now that you've accepted the musicianship in me, here's my actual identity. It seems like now, even up until like Frank Ocean, he was still like pretty big before he kind of came out as bi. Janelle Monáe is another who kind of came out a little bit late into their career, but now there's acts, Todrick Hall, there's a few people that are kind of hitting that ground saying, this is the totality of who I am immediately. Don't discount me because of my identity. Don't discount my music because you know the whole of me. And so there's a shift definitely, I think, in that way, in acceptance, but there's still a long, long way to go, especially in the genres that I am in, kind of soul and hip hop, like, you know, Lil Nas. This, we're still kind of like a bit of a taboo, not a taboo, but a novelty. And it'd be great to have this conversation. In fact, reverse that, it'd be great not to even have this conversation anymore, to get to a point where it's just music, you know, of Black origin, and it doesn't matter who you are. But yeah, so I think there's still a long, long way to go. And it seems to be, that seems to have been the shift, like, generally, like back in the day, you've got Marsha P and Sylvia Rivera, like these Black trans women who started the Pride movement that has given birth to so much freedom that we have now, kind of largely erased from history until very recently. And still, like, the oppression against Black trans people, against Black queer people, is still rife. And it's kind of this disparity between trying to celebrate the people who started this movement while still beating them down in and out of the community. So yeah, I feel like there is a shift, and especially this summer has been a huge shift in not necessarily just Black Lives Matter, but all Black Lives Matter, like whatever shade of blackness you come in, shade figuratively there. Mm-hmm. Like it seems to be a much more of a movement than a moment this time. So yeah, I think I'm talking tentatively because I tend to hold these things at a distance, and kind of like, because so often we've kind of galvanized and then something has happened and it's not pulled through, or like we keep getting knocked back. So I'm precious with the movement, I'm precious with saying, with giving too much hope, but in the same breath, yeah, can't deny there's definitely been a shift.
It's interesting what you're saying there, in that it sort of feels like people are able to express their identity, but then as soon as they do, then it becomes something that's niche or other, rather than just being part of the main conversation.
For sure. Even like when you were talking about Jordan Peele, like I'm a huge fan. I've been a fan of Peele since Key and Peele, actually.
Yeah.
I just geniuses in whatever genre they commit to. And like, yeah, the old tropes, I find myself guilty of suspecting, okay, I see there's a few black faces on this screen and whatever genre I'm in, how long is it going to be until they're disposed of? Or like, and it's crazy. I'm like, if someone like me, if I'm thinking that, then kind of there just must be a long way to go basically before we eradicate these narratives, you know? So,
I relate very strongly to everything that's been said. I think that I really never thought that I would end up writing. Not necessarily because I didn't know of any black writers, because that's not true. I grew up reading, you know, Mallory Blackman, but it was more just that there weren't very many. I think that spoken word has been like a really wonderful medium that's gained in popularity and has there are just so many brilliant black spoken word artists who've gained traction and gained like a level of success in a way that's really exciting, really inspirational. I slightly cynically think that that's because spoken word is the genre of that's close to classic literature but still kind of apes tropes that you would find in like rap and hip-hop. And I think that there's a narrative that quite likes to put black people into a box of like, if you're going to create art, it's going to look a very particular way. And so like when you were talking about loving rock and roll, like I loved rock and roll and indie music growing up, and people were always really shocked by that. And again, kind of tried to use it to diminish my blackness as if I was somehow not black enough because I liked the Arctic Monkeys or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that, yeah, there's definitely been, there are definitely strong black voices in spoken word. If that's necessarily true in the rest of literature, I'm not entirely sure. It's growing and it's getting there, but I still feel like that, and it's so structural. This is the thing, it's so structural, because I think that the solid literary foundations that you need as a kid to go on and to fulfill your potential as a writer, you don't necessarily get in every school because schools are underfunded. And you don't necessarily get given by every teacher because teachers are overworked and underpaid. And I was very lucky because I went to a fee-paying school and I went on scholarships and bursaries. But I think my mum knew that like by hook or by crook, she wanted me to go to a school like the school I went to, because she knew it would give me a better chance as a black woman to have lots of doors opened for me. And she was completely right. And I remember going to university and meeting quite a wide variety of people, given that it was a good a Russell Group university. It was quite a diverse mix of people for a Russell Group university. I went to Warwick, if you're wondering. And I remember running into lots of people who called me a coconut because I liked Shakespeare, you know? And I think that there are still these associations with, I guess, like canonical literary texts, and they're seen as texts for white people. And I think that's a big problem, because it means that, and it's also just in like the way things like Shakespeare are taught, because again, they're taught in like a very rigid, standardized way that only appeal to people who come from a certain background, who have certain opportunities, who are able to like go to the theater all the time and, you know, pay for the really expensive tickets to the Globe, and who have parents, they're able to take them and see those things. And those kids do tend to be overwhelmingly from a white middle-class background. And the black working class kids that could go on to be amazing writers if they were just exposed to more literature never get the opportunity because they're not exposed to more literature. And so I think, although it's starting and it's slow, it is happening, but I think it really starts at the bottom. It really starts like at the ground level of like what kids are able to read and see when they're 5, 6, 7, and what gets their interest and what doesn't. And I think that, you know, people often say that like Mallory Blackman created a generation of like black kids who wanted to read and write, and I really think she did, because up until the point, I'd been being given the same kind of stale old white Dickens stuff that as like a young black South London didn't massively appeal to me. And if I feel that way, given that I was raised around quite affluent people, I can't imagine how other people that didn't have the opportunities that I had must have felt about literature and books and words and reading. And so, yeah, by the time you're an adult, a lot of the work is kind of already done. You know, a lot of the damage is kind of already done in making people feel like this isn't a sphere for them. So, yeah, I think that I believe that change will come. But, yeah, like Tolu, my hope is tentative. And I don't want to, it's fragile. And I want to believe that change is coming, but it's not always easy to do so.
I think it's hard sometimes because, like, it was drilled into, well, actually, it'd be really interesting to hear what you think, Liz, about this. Mm-hmm. But I expect Ella felt the same as me, in that our parents drilled into us that in order to survive and make yourself known and do well in this country, based on their experiences of migration and the racism and prejudice that blocked doors for them, they were like, actually be like these people, work twice as hard, you know, do twice as much, and you'll maybe get half of what they get. And so you're drilled on that. And when opportunities don't come your way, even I remember my sisters not getting a paper round that our friend across the road did get. They were like 13, and there could have been a multitude of reasons why, but Dad took that opportunity to like lecture us in, this is just a beginning, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's just, this is not just a paper round. Actually, these opportunities are going to not happen for you. Yeah. And like, even down to not necessarily teaching us the language. So I'm of Yoruba origin in Nigeria. And I think that's a regret now for Mum and Dad that they didn't teach it to us or speak to us, because they really wanted us to fit in.
Yeah.
Then now the flip side of like, actually your heritage is really beautiful. It's really like, this is so much to learn. Like, don't be ashamed of history, celebrate what makes you different. And I'm like, oh, I didn't actually like grow up loving the real me, because I was told so often by people in my own family, but also from society at large, that actually it's much better for you. The more English and the more white you can be, the better it is for you. So there's this kind of disparity in me now as a sort of like 30 something, which I'd really hope that younger generations of black people aren't kind of, they haven't taken that on. And so whereas our hope is kind of tentative, actually, I wonder if younger generations are growing up in this now slightly more tolerant world and definitely more celebratory moment. So it'd be really interesting to see generationally how that affects people.
I was just going to say it's so interesting. Yeah, I had quite a similar experience, I think. And I think my parents definitely felt this conflict of wanting us to love where we're from and who we are, but also wanting us to assimilate. Absolutely. And so on one hand, my mum would like, you know, cook up the jerk chicken and the plantain because she wanted me to know my roots. But at the same time, like, we've had this conversation, but like, called me Ella because the name Ella McLeod is a very ethnically ambiguous name. To the extent that when I walk into rooms, they're really shocked that I'm black. Because I mean, McLeod is a slave name, like, we're Jamaican, most of our names are slave names. And Ella is a very kind of, Ella's look like everything all over the world. And so like, she made a point of, my sister's called Saffron, and like, those are very like ethnically ambiguous names. And so we never get discriminated against on a form, for example, because it's free. No one knows to discriminate against us. And yeah, that was definitely a conscious decision for her, I think, because she knew what kind of a world I was going to be walking into.
Yeah, it's just in response to Tolu. Absolutely. Maybe in a different form though. So for example, what you mentioned about language, we have 43 languages in Kenya. I know in Nigeria you have over 250.
I think it might be sort of everything's 520. Yeah.
But in our school, I went to a Catholic girls' school in my early years. And we were forced to not speak our language at school because we had ethnic clashes as well, but the main reason was because they want us to quote unquote rise in the world. So English is the official language in Kenya, but so is Swahili. So eventually, I used to be fluent in my ethnic language, and eventually I lost it. I understand it perfectly, but now I'm having to reteach myself on YouTube. And the thing about pressure that you talked about is absolutely true, no matter where you are. I think if you have Black parents, it's the same pressure everywhere. The idea was, you know, perception is everything. So you must get this degree, you must be in this career, you must, you know, there were milestones set from when you're like four. And that thing about owning your own place, you know, land, all those things to do with wealth or asset acquisition were very, very important. They've seen now that life is different than when we were growing up. But I think, you know, cultural shifts always take quite a while. So we're still having a bit of conflict culturally back home. It's very similar to what you've described here. But I'm finding I'm having to unlearn a lot of things related to religion, related to rejection, because rejection is common everywhere, but you do become even more paranoid in some ways, even though it's justified. So I found that I was feeling, whenever I was rejected for a job or anything, I felt it almost 1,000 times worse. It's hard to explain. So I'm unlearning some of those things. Thankfully, we have a digital world where there's free information. But I've been teaching myself a lot about how to unlearn these things. I'm not there yet. I think most of us aren't. like you were saying, yes, hope is fragile.
I guess that's what's so great about your work, Ella, is that it's inspiring children from such a young age to have this pride and that sense of identity. Is that the aim behind your work?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, like, yeah, it is. In terms of like my work in like a broader sense, that's very much, I think everything I write, I kind of write for my younger self. Maybe I'm a bit of a narcissist.
I love that. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I think it's, I'm trying to, and I have like a younger sister and younger cousins, and I'm trying to write the world as I want them to see it, I suppose. So yeah, that's definitely part of it. And also just like, you know, trying to, I think young, the world for young Black kids right now is so weird. It's such a weird place because they have all this access to, you know, as you said, Liz, like we live in a very digital world. They have all this access to other Black people and other Black people's experiences. And I think that, you know, the rise of social media has been hugely influential in breaking down some of those barriers in representation. At the same time, the rise in social media also means that, you know, my 12-year-old cousin can click on Instagram and see a Black man being shot any day of the week. Mm-hmm. And so she's hyper aware, and younger generations of Black kids are hyper aware of success for Black people being within their reach, but they're also hyper aware of the dangers and the violence that just goes with being Black. And it's such a difficult balancing act, I think, and I think it must be really troubling for them. So all of my work, I hope, will try and tackle those things and try and give them a means by which to kind of process that conflict of Black is beautiful, but also sit down and shut up, basically. Mm-hmm.
I think it's really great that you're taking the opportunity to speak to young children in the way that you want them to be spoken to, and the sort of lessons and the stories you want to get across, because I know that there's that sort of conflict where people want to shelter their children from the reality of the world, but actually, as you say, they're getting it.
Yeah, but I also think, sorry to interrupt you, I also think like Black kids don't really get sheltered from the reality of the world, even if our parents try. Like, I think the thing that's been really revealing to me over the last year is I haven't really been shocked by anything that's happened. I've been saddened and dismayed and horrified, but I've not been shocked. And I don't really remember ever being like really like viscerally, I think my earliest memory of being like shocked was maybe 9/11. But I think other than that, like every time I would see, even as a kid, a black person being killed or a racial attack, or I remember the Dami Lola Taylor incident. I mean, it's down the road from where I live now, but I remember that really clearly growing up. And I remember all of my white friends talking about it and just not being shocked and just not being surprised, because I knew that black people die all the time because they're black, and all of the statistics that came out about corona disproportionately affecting black people didn't shock me, because I know that of course a pandemic is going to affect a minority community who have like less access to healthcare, less access to resources, less access to childcare, have to go to work, are always discriminated against, are treated worse by the police, treated worse by first responders. Like, so I don't think black kids have the luxury of being sheltered all the time. And so I think what I'm trying to do is, I don't want to lie to them or tell them that like life isn't difficult, but I just want to like kind of equip them with an imagination and a bit of hope to deal with the difficult things, you know?
And one of the main themes is mortality, which seems like an intense theme, but I imagine you picked it for similar reasons.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. I think that I just can't really fathom what it must be like to be a kid right now. And some of your first experiences of school are going to school and then being pulled out of school for nearly a year. And then going back to school and all your teachers wearing masks and visors and gloves and not being able to pick you up if you cut your knee, and not being able to administer first aid, and just all of these like really important formulative human experiences that you're being denied. And then on top of that, being aware of this like heightened sense of racial tension in the world, because I think we need to give kids more credit. Like, they know when things are difficult, and they know when there is a sense of kind of like fear or anxiety, like kids can pick up on that kind of thing. And so I think it's important not to shy away from the difficult topics, but like I said, just to like equip them and give them hope and give them magic and give them all of those things that mean that they can, you know, continue in quite a dark, scary world without becoming, I guess, overwhelmed with a kind of early sense of nihilism, you know?
I was gonna ask you as well, Liz, about the topic of assimilation and if you feel that within film that is still so prevalent, even talking about sort of the last couple of years, do you feel that that pressure for young creatives and producers is still to assimilate, to get noticed?
I think the pressure is there, probably more in the commercial world than the indie film world, maybe. I'm not a filmmaker, so I can't speak too much to that. But in terms of exhibition, I haven't experienced that too much in the work that I've screened. My focus is African cinema, so already there's a whole other kind of thinking and aesthetic that comes around with storytelling. In particular, the way we treat time in our stories is very different to how the Western kind of traditions do. We think of it more in kind of a time circle, similar to maybe the Aboriginal communities. So if you look at our films, the way we treat time specifically is very similar with Indigenous people across the world. So in that sense, maybe not. But it's interesting you talk about assimilation, because I think it's John Okomfor in his film Last Angel of History. He talks about how the Black experience on Earth is like being an alien, you know? You know, we might as well be an entirely different species the way our experience on this planet is. You know, it's so bizarre, extrajudicial killings, and our lives are kind of more dispensable than other people, and it's filmed, and it's broadcast, and it's repeated over and over again. And it's just stuff like, I wish I could remember his name now, because there have been so many victims, but there was one man who was left on the road for 4 hours. His body was left there by the police as a way of kind of warning the entire neighborhood that, you know, this could be you next. And that's an old trick that's happened in the past with lynchings and other murders. And when you look at it, like, just even on paper, it's such an alien kind of feeling that a sector of the global population is treated this way globally. Assimilation is an interesting word there, because it feels there's such a schism between us and the rest of the world, even though so many of our experiences are common, actually. So I guess that's my, I don't know if I've answered the question, but it's what's in my mind at the moment.
So I think a lot of what we talked about is about the challenges behind the camera. And I just wanted to speak about how art can also be used as a tool for rebellion and speaking out against injustices. So I thought, Tulu, you might have some interesting points on this, because although you're a spoken word and hip hop artist, you're also a theatre performer and you co-organise Rainbow Noir, the Manchester-based peer support and social group for LGBTQ people of colour. Can you tell us a bit about how you came to push the visibility of queer people of colour in your artistic work?
I don't think it was initially intentional. I think it was just, I was speaking about stuff being on the margins of a margin, and it just felt easier to put that on paper and to kind of chat about it. Once I was out, it was much easier to be like, hey, this is the whole of me now. It almost felt like, because I came out after quite a dark period in my life, it almost felt a bit kind of like rock bottom in terms of I'm breaking all of the ideals and ideologies that have been passed down to me that I see in society. I'm never going to be white and I'm never going to be straight. So I need to just stop trying to be both of those things. And so here's me, I've not got anything else to give. And so in pushing my blackness, sort of like chatting about the experiences I've had that have been racially charged, it also made sense to talk about issues of homophobia that have happened, even within family and outside of it. And art has always been a really beautiful way to communicate really quite complex and sometimes quite melancholy ideas in a nice, neat package. Someone might be consuming something that they don't even realize has come from a place that they, you know, identify with just because they like music or because they like the song or whatever. So it was just easier to kind of talk about that stuff in work, almost easier than kind of chatting about it now. I'm even stumbling over my words even just now, just thinking about that time when actually it was much easier to sing about stuff than talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, issues of queerness and queer identity have always really resonated with issues of being other as a black person. And it's just been really interesting in my lifetime to hear the narrative that black and brown people, well, number one, black and brown people are not queer is often something that's said, or often something that's kind of believed within black and brown communities. And even like talking about issues of like imperialism and colonialism, when kind of religion came and Christianity came, and that was a method of control. And then African people in the past sometimes kind of envisioned queerness as a white import, and just that whole idea of how deep and how far and how damaging black colonialism was, not just like physically but emotionally, in terms of all of stuff about identity. And I don't know, just history, like if you look deep enough, and I've still got so much to learn, but you see so much queerness in our identity and in the African diaspora, like even within language, like in Yoruba there's a word, Adufuro, which I only learned not long ago, which is, it's quite blunt. It's basically someone who partakes in anal sex, and normally like a man. But the point is that the language is there, and if the language is there, then it's always been there. Like people have always got together, people have had sex for like, obviously, because we're still here. So people have expressed themselves in so many different ways. And it seems obvious to think about, but when you've been told the narrative, no, Nigerian people aren't queer, that doesn't happen here. You believe it growing up, and it's only looking back. So it just felt natural to kind of be like, actually, I am queer and I didn't force it, and this is who I am, and this is part of my life. but also I'm really conscious of that not being like the only issue that I chat about, because there's something about the privilege of not having to talk about every aspect of your being when perhaps you're a white and straight person. People don't necessarily ask you to represent all white people or to represent all straight people, but as a black gay man, I'm often like in the room because I'm black or gay or both, and expected to talk about that as if I know it all, and I really, really don't. Really, really don't. So it's quite, and there's loads of stuff that I really do know a lot about, like sci-fi and manga and, I don't know, rock and metal and stuff, and I'm like, ask me about the totality, and being black and queer is brilliant, and I really celebrate that, but also there's so many more aspects to me. So yeah, I do like to push it in work just because it feels right and it feels natural. I never saw myself growing up in the music that I liked for one reason or another. So yeah, it didn't start off being intentional, but now it's like, okay, if I can, then I will, because it's part of me, but I'll also push other stuff as well. So yeah.
The worlds have merged as well, because obviously you're a musician, but then the work you do for Rainbow Noir, those are sort of those two sections where you could keep them separate, but I guess it had made sense for it to all become part of your
art. Yeah, just what I do. And then even like the theatre stuff kind of came from as a marriage of both. The first thing I kind of got involved with theatre was a show called Rent Party with Darren Pritchard and Cheryl Martin, who run Black Gold Arts, and actually replaced one of the original actors, who's someone I know who's also black and gay and also from the same part of Merseyside that I'm from Southport. And so we already knew each other, which is great. And we are quite similar, but it's also very, very different. So the narrative of it is that five artists, black artists, narrate parts of their lives and do their bits of artwork as part of a real life rent party. Rent party being throwback to the 20s in Harlem, when people had to throw these parties and put all their skulls out and do cookouts in order to get money from people attending them and pay their rent. So we give out Monopoly money and the audience kind of like chuck money at us when we do our stuff. And also it's just a really good vehicle to talk about racism and politics and identity wrapped up in kind of like a song and a dance. So like, yeah, even that was like it was just like me, the totality of me on stage with all these other people kind of like doing their thing. And that was my entry into theatre, interactive theatre. And it's kind of just growing from there, which is great. So yeah, just this idea of blackness being otherness, in especially in the West, and that being like an advent of queerness as well. I don't think the things are separate identities at all. I think the ideas are really, really parallel and similar. Like if you're used to being on the margins of one thing, then it can lead into being on the margins of another thing. And yeah, for better or for worse, that's kind of how I've kind of grown up. So it's just what I put out.
Liz, you're nodding a lot there.
In total agreement, yes. He expressed it very well.
I think I was just going to say, yeah, completely agree with everything you just said. And I think it's why solidarity is so important, because
yeah,
I think that if once we all realise that black people and queer people and women and disabled people and poor people and workers all have the one thing in common, which is that we're being massively taken advantage of by a bigger structure, then we realise we outnumber the people, the agents of that bigger evil structure, and then we have a freaking revolution, right?
It's
just one day, man. But I think that, I think that notion of existing on the margins of the margins. Mm-hmm. At some point, we all need to look around and be like, oh, you're on the margins. Oh, you're on the margins. Okay, you know, we're also on the margins. Okay, we're all on the margins. So there are more of us on the margins than not. That's what's so crazy to me. You
know? Isn't it? It's a crazy concept, actually. That concept of being the minority or being told that's a nomenclature, but actually, yeah, we are. We do make up the majority when we look deep enough, for sure.
But it's because we don't possess, and I think this is why what you were saying is about this preoccupation with from your family, I guess, and your parents. But I think it's quite a common thing for immigrants. This preoccupation with assets and wealth and like things like material things that you can own. I think it comes from like a sense of anxiety and insecurity surrounding power, because the people that are powerful, the people that have land and property and money, and the people that tend to be disenfranchised, the people that lack those things. And it's why the police historically have been an agent of the state, because they were created to protect private property rights, which is why it's just all tied up within each other.
There's something to be said about language here, and also capitalism. I mean,
that was the thing I was glancing around. I was like, do I just have an out say?
You know, this thing called money? Like,
I mean, you know, capitalism wasn't built with the success of Black people, let alone Africans in mind, right? Having to adapt to this system that we've kind of inherited, or rather been forced into, has been really damaging to our cultures. And you find that with what Tolu was saying as well with language. So in my ethnic language, Kikuyu, we don't actually have words for he or she. You call people by their name or which family or clan they belong to. And so when you have words missing and you have to kind of use the language of quote unquote the enemy, then you get into this situation where no wonder we're all confused, you know? So yes, it's true, language can be beautiful and wonderful, but it can also let us down sometimes. And maybe we don't leave enough room for compassion in that sense of that misunderstanding and lack of connection. There's no bridge for those gaps. I think that's where I'll leave it, so that your podcast doesn't end up being an hour long. Okay.
Ella, your story time sessions and also your fiction that you're writing, is that all in English?
Yes.
Have you ever considered like bringing in different languages, just since we're talking about languages?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a thought that occurs. I'm monolingual, so it would be, I think if I were to do that, it would be an act of collaboration. I don't think I would do that by myself. I would want to write with writers who speak other languages. At the moment, I'm working in English because I think that often Black Britishness is something gets overlooked in a wider conversation about Blackness. I think often the focus is on the American context, and understandably, because I suppose the violence seems more egregious there. But I think as a result of that, we forget the small but almost equally pernicious violences that occur in this country. And it always kind of blows my mind the way that we focus on racism in the States. Because like they learned it from Britain, you know what I mean? Like they learned it from Europe. Like colonialism, America exists. America is a colonial experiment. It exists
for sure.
European racism. And so I don't know. I think that's something that we just don't talk about enough. And I think it's very easy to make racism a them problem and be like, oh my God, look at the police in America and look at Trump and look how terrible they are. And then just completely forget. And the British school system is abhorrent for this. Completely forget all of the British crimes in the oppression of Black people and people of color in general, because obviously this is Black History Month, but like we don't even talk about what Churchill did to people in India. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's the thing that gets massively overlooked and not talked about at all. I think when I was at school, we sort of touched briefly on the slave trade and looked at Martin Luther King for GCSE, and that was it for Black History, with the exception of one assembly in Black History Month. So the reason me writing in English wasn't just because I speak English. It was quite a conscious choice at the time, because my stepdad is Igbo, and so like I could have brought a bit of that in too, but I was like, no, Black British kids need to feel in touch with their Black Britishness as a separate thing from Blackness in other parts of the world, if that makes sense.
I really hear that, especially like especially the conversations that are being had now about what even is blackness and what acronyms do we use, who qualifies. And it's again going back to something I said before about like who is gatekeeping blackness. Like, when was that ever even decided? Does it think that's a colonial thing? That's like, we shouldn't be thinking that way at all in terms of like who gets to be in our club and who's excluded, because the more we do that, I just feel like the more walls are going up and the more infighting that we'll have. So it's definitely strong. I think it's really, really strong to kind of focus on Black Britishness, for sure. It's definitely strong also not to forget where we're from, like what our parents had to go through and their parents, and then also like across the diaspora as well. Like you can go so deep, but obviously we're celebrating this 75th anniversary of the Pan-African Congress, and like that concept of Pan-Africanism, like, number one, people still talking about Africa like it's a country. And so, like, when you think of the continent and just the deep history and the richness, in fact, my partner said to me not long ago, a partner, Scottish, and we were watching Black is King by Beyonce. If you've not watched it, anyone listening, then please, please stop what you're doing just now. Get Disney Plus on a rental on trial and watch Black is King, and it's just beautiful. Even on mute, it's great, but with the sound, it's beautiful, so rich. And he was just like, man, I just feel so I just feel like my history and my culture and my heritage is not as rich as yours. And I kind of had two responses. I was like, number one, no, it's not. It's like, number one, it's just different. It's just different. And the reason why it feels so vivid is because it's so new and because it's so not taught. There's so much depth and history here in Britain and in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, Ireland, you know, all the devolved nations have so much history. It's just so much more accessible. And suddenly now there's this explosion of Pan-Africanism and people are like, this is great. And I'm like, it's not new. It's just... Do you know what I mean? It's just new to us. We've not been taught it. So I just feel like that is exciting to me. There's so many pockets of blackness to explore, for want of a better word. And I think it's none is more important than the other. So yeah, I think you do write definitely for writing for Black British kids. It's really cool.
Definitely the beauty of Black History Month as well. But also, I guess you want to get to the point where, would you guys like it to get to a point where we just didn't have Black History Month, it was unnecessary?
Speaking as an outsider, in a way, only if they were celebrated in the same way or as much as everybody else. If that's not the case, then you must keep this happening, this Black History Month. Otherwise, we'll just get lost in the sauce as usual. It's just my feeling. Yeah. I don't know how you guys do. I know I'm aware I'm not, you know, I'm not Black British, so, but you know.
The reason why the reason why I'm stuttering is because I just don't ever see that as being as happening right now. And that's probably quite a sad thing to kind of confront, but I'm like, how could that ever be possible? Like, we get to a point where Black British history is on an equal plane as White British history. And I'm still like rolling my eyes here, kind of like trying to think of what that would even look like.
Maybe for kids, that's the kind question. Maybe that's the question. What does that look like?
I think that's not just a race thing, is it? That's a drastic overhaul of society in general.
Hugely.
One doesn't happen without the other. So that's post-racial, post-homophobia, post-gender, post-post. Like everything. And I feel like we're still at a point where Black History Month doesn't even get enough attention.
You know, right, yeah.
You know, like, so I think we need to get to a point where we have like an oversaturation of Black History Month and then get to a point where we can move beyond it.
A point where I can be like, oh, I'm doing this thing for Black History Month, and someone doesn't reply, what is Black History Month? Or when is that? That's like, it's just like attainable goals, like that is good.
That still happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess because it conflates, there's differences between the months, between Black US history. I thought that was a USA thing. you know.
Well, I thought that was in February is when I got
off. Yeah,
America, not here. Yeah,
so like that even though it's still far off, is still something I can see, and that would be a really beautiful moment where it's like, this is an established thing. Like,
Tolu, could you tell us a bit about the Sound Sessions event and a little about the music you and Aidan create?
So yeah, what are we providing? I'm a showman, so I don't want to give everything away. I'll give you enough to entice people to come, hopefully, and listen to us. Me and Aidan are part of a band called Pieces of a Man. We're a 6-piece soundscape and soul collective, rooted in neo soul. We cover hip hop and jazz and a lot of different other genres that come together. 4 out of 6 of us are white, and me and Aidan bring the melanin. Aidan's from Bermuda, and I'm of Nigerian heritage. So when we got approached for this opportunity, it made sense for me and Aidan to team up and do something together. We've worked together in lots of other projects, but this will be the first time we've done this in terms of originality and bringing our original flavour to a project together. And it's really exciting. So we're going to bring a lot of flavours from Pieces of a Man. We're kind of reworking a lot of our stuff and bringing some stuff that hasn't seen the light of day before, actually. Everything is kind of centered around identity, racial issues that we've encountered, and just celebrating ourselves as well in that, and just questioning a lot about how we connect, especially over the pandemic. And yeah, so just a lot of us, really, using the medium of spoken word and some loops and samples, and a live element as well. So yeah, I'm well excited, actually. I often feel like Black History Month, when people bring stuff, particularly artists, and even the whole narrative around Black History Month is always very celebratory, can be quite tokenistic in terms of, look at this first Black person to do this, or this is an amazing piece of Black art and culture. And often what isn't presented is the nastiness and just the crudeness and the oppression and the struggle and just the rawness of what Black history really is. And I think, we're not being afraid of bringing something that's a little bit darker to the table, because it's all part of the story, and things might not be as beautiful as we are, and definitely would just be more surface level if we didn't encounter and didn't bring part of the hardships that we've been through, as well as the good times. I think it all makes a complete story. So yeah, I said I wasn't going to give too much. I've actually just like explained quite a lot. But yeah, hopefully you guys will check us out when we play. Well, excited to come through.
So in terms of Black History Month and how much lockdown and coronavirus has affected it this year, because obviously you can't have a podcast in 2020 without talking about the lockdown.
Sure.
Do you feel like Black History Month hasn't had the attention it deserved this year? Obviously it's a very particular year for other reasons as well. So how do you feel the month's gone so far?
I would probably say the opposite.
I was the exact same thing.
But only because, number one, everyone's glued to a screen, so it's hard not to, you'd have to try really hard to avoid it. If you're looking, also the Black Lives Matter movement over the summer, and just this kind of energy, this anti-racist energy, which is good. So I think it is getting the attention that it deserves, but it's still not, I want to say household name, that's like, it sounds really quite trivializing what I mean, but it's still not normalized. It's still not like a part and ingrained into what it is to be British. Like, being Black is still other from that, I feel. So I think it's definitely in the right direction this year. And I think it's almost sad that it took a global pandemic for there to be a spotlight on the injustices that are still happening towards Black people, but you know, it's happened and we kind of deal with it, and people are looking right now, so it's time to kind of it isn't time to take the foot off the pedal. It's time to actually galvanize more whilst there is this spotlight. Personally, I don't know how you guys feel.
I think some of the efforts I've seen have been really lazy. There's lots of good stuff. There's lots and lots of good stuff. But when you look at some of these online platforms that, you know, you can stream stuff on, they have these Black Lives Matter collections and so on. But there isn't that much care that's taken into making them. So there are films and TV shows that are in there that shouldn't be in there. You know, they're in there just because they're made by a Black filmmaker, but actually the content is about something else. It doesn't celebrate Black lives. So some efforts have been lazy. Yes, it's nice that they're there. But if you're not going to put the effort, why in a way that's even worse. But also in terms, it's interesting you talk about this in the context of lockdown, like, because an artist I know, Sakai, she has an art kind of mural installation in Dundee at the moment that got taken down. And my understanding is that there was funding available set aside in case that were to happen, and that, what does that tell you already? Fingers crossed they'll be able to pull it back up. But even in lockdown, artwork is being torn down that's celebrating Black History Month. So it's we've been winning in some ways, and in other ways we're kind of going backwards. It's the same story.
I think I generally agree that the fact that everyone's been glued to a screen has been helpful. And I think I really saw that in the protests over the summer. I think the fact that, like, Gen Z weren't in school, so they were on the streets, you know, and people weren't at work, so they could protest. And I think that lent itself to the energy behind, because this isn't the first time a Black person's been murdered by a cop. Right. So I think the fact that everyone was at home and able to be really vocal about it, and also just a general sense of a lot of people being very angry with world governments and angry with authority and angry with law enforcement anyway, I think really added fuel to that fire. I think the thing that I'm, I guess, kind of cynical about is in much the same way as I'm kind of cynical when I see this happening at Pride, I'm seeing a lot of corporate co-opting of Black History Month in a way that just feels commercial. And like you say, there's not a lot of care that's gone into it. It's a sort of like tokenism, flag raising, virtue signaling thing to be like, look what good work we're doing. But actually it's like, do you have that many Black employers? Have you donated to this fund or that fund? Like, are you actually doing the work to support Black people, or do you just want to look like you are? And I think I've seen quite a lot of that in the last, this month, but also in the month prior, because of the rise in the kind of vocality of BLM in the last few months. So yeah, it's a yes and no, I think. I mean, I think that will always happen. I think as long as we have corporations who stand to gain something and who stand to make a profit, they're always going to try and use what they can in order to do that. And if the cultural zeitgeist feels in favor of BLM, they're gonna take advantage of that. I just hope that people who care can see through it and know that, like, you know, like, yeah, just because you watched Netflix's Black Lives Matter playlist doesn't mean that did you know what I mean, like, it had, and I completely agree with you because I saw it too, and I saw the streaming platforms that didn't, like, it's like, just because, like, Will Smith is in something, it doesn't mean,
you know,
like, I love Will Smith, but, like,
I still stand, cool. Yeah, I was gonna say, I still stand Will Smith.
Yeah, I stand Will Smith, but that's not quite what we're talking about in terms of, like,
it's also this constant thing of, you, we ask for one thing but they give us something else, and I'm just like, they're not listening to what we're actually saying.
On the same note, when you talk about corporations getting involved and, like, the pink pound, that concept, I wonder if there'll be something called the brown pound or the black pound. I used to like actively avoid it, like, no, you're a corporation, I don't want anything to do with you, you've not got the same heart. Equally, I'm like, you know what, that's a platform, like, and I'll take your coin if you're offering it to me right now, because one, I'm a Black artist and I feel like that money should be, is deserved, but two, I know that I can use it in a way that's beneficial. So it's like, yeah, the sources might be conflicted and confused and some tokenistic. I think everything kind of starts with tokenism at this point anyway. And it's just up to people like people like us and others like us and allies and stuff to just kind of utilize that in a way.
Yeah,
like it's going to happen as long as capitalism happens. That's going to happen. So how do we use that?
I think if they're putting money into things, it's different because, like you say, as a Black artist, you can use it and you can kind of share some of that wealth around the movement. It's when there's no like material investment going.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's just like liking a picture on Instagram. I just kind of roll my eyes, you know.
Yeah, or a black square on Instagram or whatever it is. Yeah.
So which of the organisations out there that you feel are doing a really great job in terms of supporting Black creatives, is there a shout out that you want to give?
Oh gosh, there are many. I mean, on my end, I'm going to subvert your question a little bit, Meg, and say that there are many, many shoulders that we are standing on. You know, we've got, just musically, you were talking about Tolu. Skin from Skunk Anansie.
Yes.
Huge for me when I was growing up. Yeah. And you've got Andre 3000 and Fela Kuti and at the moment someone that's really bringing me a lot of joy is Munya Chawawa, who's a comedian. He's on Twitter. I think everyone's familiar with his videos. His satire is just absolutely perfect and on notes and very quick. He's a very quick artist. If you can find him on Twitter, make him happy. I think he's got a Netflix show now. In terms of film exhibition, I will say yes. Lincoln Center, the Film Lincoln Center, have been doing amazing work online with Q&As and so on. And also Princeton University of all people, the Lewis Center is doing an amazing season at the moment on kind of rebellious filmmakers or women that have been on the margin for so long and you know, unpraised for too long. And it includes people like Julie Dash and Angela Davis in their what do they call them? Q&As and conversations. And of course, I have to shout out my own festival. Africa in Motion, we have a festival coming up at the end of October throughout the entire November. And at the moment, we've partnered with the four other big African festivals in the UK to screen 10 of the best contemporary films for free. You can see them on africainmotion.org.
Amazing. And do you guys also have things that you want to plug? Any exciting projects coming up?
Well, yeah, shout out Black Gold Arts, Manchester based. Just plugging everything that's Black and artistic and beautiful. Shout out to you guys home, really appreciate this platform as well. Shout out to Rainbow Noir and the opportunities that we're creating in platforming queer people of colour, UK Black Pride. Like, there's a lot of kind of things that started grassroots that are getting a lot more just organised, I guess, in that respect. Or maybe people are paying more attention. And money kind of talks. So it's good that actually these organizations are rising up and really creating solid platforms that aren't just like a moment or a tick box, becoming really rooted. So yeah.
I don't know, I guess I would just shout out like other like writers. So I really like Sophia Thacker on Instagram. She's an amazing Black poet. Dean Atter, the Pink Flamingo, he's incredible.
Yes.
Like, just amazing. Obviously Monroe Bergdorf is just like a queen. I think that like Instagram in this time has been just like such an incredible platform for like Black artists sharing their work. So yeah, those are sort of the three that spring to mind. Yeah.
Oh, Ella has just reminded me something, that this weekend, to celebrate International Day of the Girl, there's some really amazing writers who are going to talk about writing for Black protagonists. Irenesen Okojie, she won the Kane Prize this year. Chinonyerem Odimba, she's a playwright. Uh-huh. And also Yero Timibiu, she's like a BFI Talent Award winner. They're speaking on Saturday. Yeah.
Great. Thank you all so much for being part of the podcast and also part of Black History Month in general. It's been lovely to talk to you this evening.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you so much. Cheers for having us.
It's been so lovely.
Thank you for joining us. And thanks to Liz, Tolu and Ella for being on the podcast. Ella McLeod's Storytime Session, Selina and the Spider, is a three-part series with the first available online from Monday the 26th of October at 11:30 a.m. If you'd like to hear more from Liz, she'll be speaking on the panel as part of Black Mirror, Representations of Race in the Horror Film, a live Zoom event on Thursday the 29th of October at 6 p.m. Tolu will be performing as half of Tolu and Aidan as part of the Home Sound Sessions, available online on the 30th of October at 7:30 p.m. Remember, our Black History Month programme, packed with film, theatre, art and special events, runs throughout October, giving you every chance to enjoy the wealth of Black talent on screen, on stage and online. All tickets can be purchased on our website at homemcr.org or by calling our box office team. Our full Black History Month programme is available on our website. Thanks again and see you soon at home.